Welcome to Stunt Stories. I'm Corey Eubanks. You know, as a professional stuntman, part of your goal, well, the majority of us, part of your goal is not only to have a successful stunt career, performing stunts as a stuntman or as a stuntwoman, but you do want to climb up the ladder. You want to eventually become a stunt coordinator. And then once you've accomplished that, you want to become a second unit director. And then if you can, which is happening more often than not, the stunt coordinator that has become the second unit director then graduates up to become the first unit director of either an episodic television show or a feature film, or feature films, I should say. There's a lot of very successful stuntmen who have made that leap. They have grown their careers that direction and have accomplished great things. One of our forefathers way back in the day was Hal Needham, who had done that. He was the first that to come up through the industry as a professional stuntman and second unit director, and then direct films like Smokey and the Bandit and Hooper and Cannonball Run. Just an incredible directing career. And a lot of us have all thought, wow, you know, if we could just follow in Hal Needham's footsteps. And for a little bit there in my career, that was my goal. That's what I wanted to do. And I was accomplishing that. I was directing second unit episodic television shows, such as Sunny Spoons for Stephen J. Cannell, some shows for Stu Siegel Productions, Silk Stockings, Renegade, High Tide, you know, then for Columbia TriStar, I was doing Sheena and Pacific Blue, and have actually been very, very, very fortunate in that world to have directed quite a bit of television. I mean, 20 one-hour television shows. And then I was fulfilling a dream of mine that was to write a screenplay and direct it as well. And before that, though, I had written and starred, I hate to say starred because I'm not a star, I just played the lead role in a movie called Payback. That was in 1989. I wrote that screenplay and played the lead. And then also, I wrote another screenplay called Forced to Kill and played the lead opposite Michael Ironside. And really enjoyed that, but wanted to be the storyteller. Not the guy on camera that was saying the dialogue and trying to hit his camera mark and trying to find your key light and being focused. It just, the acting for me was so limitless. It was, especially if you're playing a part that somebody else wrote, and it was just not for me. It was just something. I tried it. I did it. I've been in, you know, dozens of films and TV shows playing roles, playing, you know, various characters, and have just really not enjoyed being the on-camera actor. I'd rather be the on-camera stunt performer. But I did enjoy a great deal the writing a screenplay and directing. Probably some of the best memories I have come in the film and television industry have come from writing and directing my own movies, which I can say I've done too. That's not a long list, but it is too. And it's funny how that came about. The one film that I had, my second movie that I had made, Forced to Kill, that one film was being sold overseas, and my foreign distributor was a company called PM Entertainment, and a company owned by Joseph Marhi and Rick Pepin. That was the P and the M. And the other third partner of the company was George Shimi. But they didn't want to have his S for his last name, because then their company would be called PMS. And that might be, you know, taken wrong. So they left it at PM Entertainment. And I was in their offices one day going over the foreign sales of this movie I had made called Forced to Kill. because I was also the producer of it. I self-financed it. I made a bunch of deferred deals with post-production sound houses like Third Street Sound with a gentleman named Steve Ogden. And even Michael Ironside had deferred his payment, trusting in me that I would make these foreign sales and be able to pay everybody what we had agreed on. And I did, and it worked, but it was time consuming. It took a long time. You just don't go in when you make all these foreign sales, they've got 90 days to pay you. And then that's just your foreign sales. And then you get to the domestic ancillary markets. Back in the day, this was VHS, video cassettes, if you could still remember those things. And then to sell your video, they had a 6-month window before you could then go and sell your pay-per-view. And then once it was on pay-per-view, then there was cable. And they each one of these, they each had a 6-month window and before you then could sell your syndicated television. So it's like two and a half years before you get all your money in. And that was hard to try to be a movie production company when you only have enough financing to make one movie and then sit there and wait for the money to dribble in a little bit at a time. So I was frustrated, and I would show up at PM Entertainment, and I would go over the foreign sales with George Shimi and see how we were doing and when we were going to collect monies, because I was, very eager to pay the people that I had on deferment and be a man of my word. And I would stay on top of it, and I'd show up there once or twice a week sometimes just to look over the sales. And I was in his office, and the movie Free Willy had just come out. And huge box office success, huge, huge movie at the time. And I remember George Shimi looking at the cover of the Hollywood Reporter, I think it was. And he was like, "Oh, we need to make a movie, a children's film, a family movie. We need to do a movie about a small boy and a big animal." Because in Free Willy, it was a story about a small boy and a whale. A big animal. Just kidding around. I said, "Yeah, you ought to do a movie about Bigfoot. He's pretty popular." And he turns around and he looks at me. And this look of excitement. And he goes, "Cody, do you have..." I'm imitating George Shimi, by the way. "Cody, do you have a movie about the Bigfoot?" I said, "Coincidentally, I'm working on a story." Now, that was kind of a lie and kind of not, because the second that he asked me if I had a movie about Bigfoot or a script, I think he said, "Do you have a script about Bigfoot?" The second he said that, my mind clicked into what story could I come up with. So when I said to him that I was working on it, that was partially true, because from that second forward, I was working on a story about a small boy and Bigfoot. So George, I told him, "Yes, I do." And he got all excited and he picked up his phone and he called upstairs to the other two owners of the company, to Joseph Marhi and Rick Pepin, and said, you guys come down here right away, right now. Cody's going to tell us a story about a Bigfoot movie that we're going to produce." I'm like, "Oh my gosh, this is really advancing rapidly here." And I'm thinking, I better come up with a good story. So these other two gentlemen come into the room and they all three sit down on the couch. And I remember George Shimi turning to his assistant who had her desk just outside his office door. And he said, "Hold all my calls, you hold them." And he shuts the door and sat down beside Joseph Marhi and Rick Pepin. And they all crossed their legs the exact same way. I'll never forget that. That was like, whoa. And they leaned back on the couch and said, "Cody, tell us this story. Tell us the story. This is..." And he turns to Rick Pepin and he goes, "This is a Bigfoot movie that we're going to produce." I said, "Well, there's this small boy and this huge animal known as Bigfoot. And I pulled this story out of my butt, literally. I didn't even know where the direction of the story was going. And I just made up this story and walked out of there with $1.5 million deal. That's how much they wanted to spend on the movie, and a start date of June 15th. By me just pulling a story out of my butt and pitching it to them, and they bought it. And the reason being is they were going to be finishing another movie, and they wanted to roll that same company, all of their crew members, rather than letting them off and then trying to gather them all up again. They'd go work for other production companies. They wanted to hang on to their film crew that they had and roll them right into another film. So that's why the June 15th date, which gave me 7 weeks before I would start pre-production. 7 weeks to write a screenplay. And, you know, there have been screenplays that have been written in less time. I was a little intimidated about the 7 weeks. I have written a total of 11 screenplays in my lifetime. And 4 of them have been produced into feature films. So not quite a 50% average, but up there. And I left a little intimidated about this whole deal, that I was going to be the writer-director of this movie, but excited. I remember calling my wife and telling her what had just happened. And, you know, she was asking me all these questions, like, where are you going to shoot it? And what are you going to do about Bigfoot? You know, he doesn't really exist, and all this stuff. And I hung up the phone and I called Rance Howard, who I met on a movie called Far and Away. And when I was doing my Forced to Kill movie, Ron Howard, who was directing Far and Away, had asked me as a favor if I would use Rance, his father, in my Forced to Kill movie, and if I had a spot for his brother Clint Howard, which I did. I hired them both and did some rewrites on the script and had them both in the movie. And based on that relationship I developed with Rance Howard, we became writing partners and wrote a script together and about the stunt industry, which we never got produced. But I hung up with my wife at the time, and my first wife, hung up the phone with her, and I immediately called Rance Howard and said, Rance, are you sitting down? I got to tell you something. I said, I just walked out of a meeting. I pitched a story about Bigfoot, and I have 7 weeks to write the screenplay. Would you please help me write this script? And he said, Corey, Ron and Clint and I have been Bigfoot fans all of our lives. You come by the house. So he lived in Toluca Lake at the time. And I don't know if you're aware of Rance Howard and the remarkable career that he's had as an actor. Unbelievable man. Unfortunately, he's no longer with us. Trust me, had you met Rance Howard, you would have been one of your next best friends. He was just such a wonderful, wonderful, intelligent man. Great writer. And I went by his house, came to his house, and on his coffee table, he had a stack of newspaper clippings that was probably 3 inches thick of all of the newspaper clippings and articles and magazine articles and photos of Bigfoot sightings. That was like their hobby. That was a little hobby that they had, was collecting things about Bigfoot. So he was like a little kid, so excited about helping me write this Bigfoot script and coming up with the story. And at the time, we had this earthquake in Northridge in California. And Ron Howard was working on in post-production on this movie called The Paper, and doing the editing and the sound effects editing and just getting ready to wrap up this film in post-production when they had the earthquake. So he didn't want to stay in his apartment, which was like, you know, on the 30th floor or something downtown. And so he stayed at his mom and dad's house where he grew up. And every morning at 8:30, I would show up, and Jean, Ron's mother, who is also no longer with us, what a sweetheart of a lady she was. You could see her in Apollo 13. Sheep and Rance, they both had parts in Apollo 13. And Gene would fix us breakfast, and we would sit at this little table, the little dinner table, at the well, not the dinner table, at the counter, and sometimes at the table. But I remember this one particular part of the story. I'm going to tell you, we were at the counter in the kitchen, and Rance and I were working on this, the story, the structure of the story. And Ron was privy to what it was, because every morning we would talk about it, and he was kind of learning as we would advance the story. And I remember one day we had changed it drastically, and Ron looked up. He was eating a bowl of cantaloupe, and he looked up and he says, "Dad, Corey, you guys just changed the whole subplot of the story." And we're like, "Yeah, we did. Now we're going to go this direction with it." And he goes, "You can do that? You guys can just change the story whenever you want to?" I'm like, "Well, yeah, I mean, I you know, they just asked me to write the screenplay, and we're going to start shooting, you know, June 15th. So, you know, I took the liberty to make the change." And he goes, "You don't have to check with anybody?" I said, "No." And he goes, "Wow, I can't do that." And I go, "Well, Ron, I don't know what little movies you're working on, but, you know, this is a Bigfoot movie and I could do what I want." It was funny that I thought, wow, in that corporate world, you know, when you have a company, you know, Imagine Entertainment, in a, you know, publicly held company, there's certain laws and stuff that really restricts your freedom from doing a low budget movie like I was doing, where they're like, you know, you got the liberty to do whatever you want to do, just bring it in on time and on budget. So that was interesting to me to learn that. But it was a lot of fun to work with Rance and even design what the Bigfoot was going to look like. And we were working with this special effects company in North Hollywood, and really attention to detail of everything, the evolution of man and where, you know, when our human beings, you know, became, you know, developed out of monkeys, out of apes. If you believe that, a lot of people don't believe that, the evolution of man from we were, you know, originally, you know, apes and grew up into humans. I happen to believe that. And we found that missing link right in the, it was like, "Well, you're not really an ape anymore. You're a human, but boy, you kind of look like a big hairy person." So we found that, and we decided that this Bigfoot in our movie was going to be 7 feet tall. And so we were designing this suit to be 7 foot tall, but now I got to find a living, breathing human being to be inside this suit. This Bigfoot suit that cost us $147,000 to make. Now, that might not sound like a lot of money to you, or maybe it does, but when you have $1.5 million budget and $147,000 is being taken out of it to go for a Bigfoot suit, suddenly it means a lot. It's a lot of money. And it was really incredible how they made the eyebrows could move and the lips could move and the ears could move. This was all off remote control. So they had these battery packs that they built into the back shoulder blades of this Bigfoot suit. And this the head itself was over $40,000. And so we started this casting to find someone. I wanted someone with brown eyes. I didn't want to have blue. I didn't want to have a Bigfoot with blue eyes or with green eyes. I wanted Bigfoot to have brown eyes. And I found this gentleman, and his name was Gary. I think it was Gary Melanson. Gary. And he already was 6 feet, 7 inches tall. So at 6 foot seven, we put some lifts on the feet of this costume, this Bigfoot suit. And then on top of his head, they extended the top of the head. So he was exactly 7 foot tall. Well, while I was scouting locations up in Shaver Lake and all up Northern California, trying to find the locations for the script, as we were still writing the screenplay, I would have to fly on location and go check out certain little towns and, you know, creeks and lakes and stuff that we were going to film. And while I said, you know, simultaneously still writing the screenplay, it was crazy. And then working with these special effects men on the Bigfoot suit. And they called me one day and they said, Corey, we got a problem. And I said, what's that? This gentleman that you've hired to be, you know, inside the Bigfoot suit, he's claustrophobic. And I'm like, well, so what? That doesn't matter. We're going to be outdoors. We're going to be filming out in the wilderness. He's going to be outside. He won't even be in. No. You don't understand, Corey. When we put the Bigfoot head on him and we Velcro the back and we lace it up nice and tight the way it's supposed to fit him, he can't, he starts to freak out after about 1 or 2 minutes. He wants to take it off. He's claustrophobic. I'm like, well, do I need to get rid of him and find someone who's not claustrophobic? And they said, well, you know what? We've already spent over $20,000 on the facial molds and making this head that only fits him. So what we're suggesting is that we make another mask similar that he can take home and wear. And he's going to have to wear it while he's watching TV. And if he can, just go to bed wearing it. He's got to get comfortable wearing this mask. So I called Gary and had that conversation with him. And I said, look, we're going to put you on payroll. We're going to put you on payroll for 3 weeks. You're going to get paid to keep, you know, a log of how much time you're wearing this mask every day. You got to do this for me, or I got to replace you and get someone else. So he agreed. He agreed that he would do it. And I had an assistant on the film that would check in with him every day to see what he was doing, where he was, because he was on payroll. You know, we had a right to do that and find out, are you wearing the mask and how are you feeling? And well, he started getting very comfortable with it. And the next thing you know, we are up in Shaver Lake and we're filming. And I've got this young actor, Zachary Ty Bryan. He used to be in the TV show Home Improvements. He's playing the young boy and that's going to be rescued by Bigfoot out in the woods when he gets lost. And I've got the actor Matt McCoy from The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. He's playing the park ranger and who's going to be out there and trying to find this lost boy. And David Rashi was playing the millionaire who wanted to have Bigfoot captured and killed so he could have him stuffed and placed in his museum in Chicago. And so, yeah, it was next thing you know, it was quite surreal that we had just finished the screenplay like the week before. And next thing you know, we're on location up in Shaver Lake and we're filming and it's like, you know, week number 2 or 3 into production. And I'm like, I can't believe we're making this Bigfoot movie. This is just crazy. And it's so much fun. And we're standing there on set and I was very proud of Gary because he'd been, you know, wearing this Bigfoot suit, you know, sometimes up to 10 hours during the day. And the puppeteers would crack open the mouth and have these fans that they'd blow air in there to try to keep them nice and cool because it would get very hot inside. And we're standing there and all of a sudden, Matt McCoy turns and looks at Gary and says, and points right at his head and goes, your head's on fire. And you don't say that to someone wearing a $147,000 Bigfoot suit who has a history of being claustrophobic. This man completely freaked out and tried to pull this head, this $40,000 remote control head off of his head, but it was so tightly Velcroed and laced up the back that he couldn't and only got it like maybe a quarter of the way up his head. Yes, there was smoke coming out of the top of Bigfoot's head. What had happened were the battery packs that were in the back shoulder blades of this suit. The wires up apparently over the weeks of him wearing it and sweating in it, and I guess the wires rubbing against each other wore through the, you know, the plastic covering of the wire, and they shorted out and there was an electrical short, which caused the foam inside the suit and the hair to catch fire. So some of the grips and other crew members were trying to wrestle Gary down to the ground to hold him still, and so they could unlace and un-Velcro and take this helmet, this head off of him. Simultaneously, while I'm watching this go down, while I'm watching my Bigfoot actor be tackled to the ground and being held by these grips and a couple of the stunt guys so they could try to get this head off this screaming individual who it did burn him on the side of his eye a little bit. There was a little burn, little brand mark kind of. While this is happening, I hear off to the side a person yelling, "Look out, look out, look out." And we look, a lot of us look that direction because you can't, when someone's yelling, "Look out," well, what are you talking about? And this motorhome that we had, for some reason, that was parked on the side of this hill, this dirt road, kicked into neutral and was rolling down the dirt road toward a 10-ton truck that had the tailgate down. And standing in front of the tailgate that was about at the height of this young man's stomach, there was a gentleman there, this young man that was in the film department with the camera department, and he was changing out a film magazine. And he had headphones on. You could tell he was kind of moving his body to the rhythm of the music with his back to this motorhome that's gaining speed as it's going down the dirt road directly towards him. So I'm looking at that, and the gentleman who was yelling, "Look out, look out," was one of our production assistants, who was maybe 5'7", weighed about 200 pounds, maybe more. Not the most athletic looking individual, but extremely fast. And thank God, because this, what in my opinion could be like an Olympic sprinter, was racing across this field, running toward that motorhome, yelling, "Look out, look out." And this guy gets up alongside this motorhome, and on the driver's side, the window was down. Thank God the window was down. But if you know a motorhome, that's still quite a leap. And this Superman jumped, literally just running as fast as he could, and dove into the front window. And with his hand, just his feet sticking out the back, his hand reached down and pushed on the brake that stopped this motorhome about 10 feet before it was going to cut this other young man in half by smashing him into the tailgate, the lift gate, this lift gate of this 10-ton truck. That is happening simultaneously as we're wrestling Bigfoot's head off of him. It was one of the craziest days on set that I can recall in my 40-year career. It was just, I mean, it's funny now, but it was very, very scary and sad, because when we got the head off of Gary, he was crying. And to see a 6'7" grown man crying because he thought he was going to lose his life. He thought he was going to burn to death, I guess. It was just unbelievable. It was unbelievable, which that whole tone of the shoot rolled over into the next day when I had a real live bear on set, and the bear's name was Bogey. And we had hired this gentleman to work with this bear. And I made it very clear to him that what happens is Zachary Ty Bryan gets lost in the woods. They're up camping. He goes for a hike with his buddy and they get separated and he gets lost and he's walking, trying to find his way back to camp. And he steps in a bear trap, and the bear trap, slams onto his leg, and he's yelling and screaming from the pain of it. And Bigfoot hears it and sees him, but Bigfoot is up on a cliff. Well, this bear, which was just around the corner of these big boulders, heard him as well. And the bear comes around the corner and sees this boy laying on the ground in excruciating pain. And the bear is going to charge this kid to eat him, kill him, eat him. And Bigfoot sees it, and Bigfoot's going to jump off this cliff and land right in front of the bear and fight this bear. So that's the scene that we're going to shoot. But the first piece I needed was I needed to have this bear come around the corner, see the boy, and just run as fast, just charge and exit camera left. So I explained to the bear handler, the man who owned the bear, that's my shot. That's what I need. And he says, absolutely. No problem, Corey. We got this. Well, he would take marshmallows and go the path that I had pointed out to him. And about every 6 feet, he'd drop a marshmallow. So then he would have the bear walk the path to find each marshmallow. And I was explaining to him, no, you do understand this bear needs to be charging. He needs to be running as fast as a bear can run through the set and exit camera left. He goes, oh yeah, I'm just getting him familiar with the path that he's gonna take. So we stood there for about a half an hour watching him show this bear his path using marshmallows. And then he explained to me that I can't say roll cameras and we can't call out action because this bear has been on many, numerous movie sets and TV sets, and him hearing those words makes him nervous. So he said, I'll just point to you when you guys should roll camera, and then you point to me, back to me, when is action to send the bear. And I thought to myself, okay. Now, at this point, I really didn't have a whole bunch of confidence that I was going to get the shot that I was looking for. And he gets the bear back behind the big boulder, and we wait for another 5 minutes or so as he takes the chain off, and then he pokes his head out around the corner of the boulder and makes eye contact with us, and he points to us. And so Alex Gaynor, who was my first assistant director, he turns to the camera guys and makes this little motion with his finger and, swirling his finger in a circle, mean roll camera. So they turned on the cameras, and the, camera operator looks at me and goes, we're rolling. We've got camera speed. So I point back at the bear handler, and we're waiting. And here this bear walks out from behind the boulder and looks the direction of the boy. And I'm like, okay, now charge, just charge as fast as you can. Well, the bear stands up on his hind legs and starts sniffing the air. And apparently he smelled something in the opposite direction that was a lot more interesting to him than the damn marshmallows that we had lined out there on the ground. And he took off running the opposite direction. Disappeared. For 4 hours, the bear is gone. Took off into the woods. We couldn't find him for 4 hours. 4 hours of my day, that's all I had to shoot was this bear, him charging through frame and then fighting my Bigfoot, which I had another Bigfoot suit, which our stunt Bigfoot suit, which a gentleman named Jeff Jensen, who was 6'4", was going to wear this suit and fight Bigfoot. And I remember when we were writing that scene in Rance Howard's kitchen, and Ron, this was another morning having breakfast, and Ron goes, he asks me, hey, Corey, Ron Howard is asking me, how are you going to shoot that scene? And I'm like, well, I'm not really, really sure, Ron. I haven't really, put together a shot list or anything, but now you need to know that I had, by this point, I had already worked with Ron on a couple of movies. We did Far and Away together, where I had taught Tom Cruise to do 9 different fight scenes. And I was working hand in hand with Ron Howard on camera placements for all of the fights that we were shooting. And we worked on Backdraft. I worked for him on Backdraft. And so we had a relationship of discussing camera placements and camera angles and how to cover fights. So he was asking me how I was going to cover the fight on this Bigfoot movie. And I said, I'm not really sure, Ron. He goes, would you mind if I gave you an idea? And I'm thinking to myself, wow, Ron Howard wants to give me an idea that I can use and incorporate into my movie. I'm like, yeah, Ron, what's your idea? And he explained to me that it would be very, very more impressive and empowering and interesting and you know, the power of the imagination of your brain. Like when you read a book and you're just reading words, but you're envisioning things. And so his philosophy was, if I had a long lens that was focused on Zachary Ty Bryan, the young boy whose leg was stuck in the bear trap, if my focus was on his face, and in the foreground I had the bear and the Bigfoot more obscured, out of focus, and crossing through lens from right to left and then left to right, and just kind of every once in a while crossing through lens, and we could hear them off camera, you know, the bear and the Bigfoot making the noises that they would be making, the growls and the heavy breathing, and, you know, and let the boy's face tell the story of how gruesome or how violent or scary or, you know, how horrific this fight is that he's watching. And I thought, wow, that's a great, I never would have thought of that. And I thought, what a great idea. And I'm going to do that. Well, when my bear ran off to go play in the woods for 4 hours, that idea completely just left my brain. It was such a strong idea. I didn't even have it on my shot list. I knew that I was going to focus on that. That was going to be what I wanted to do. And when that bear disappeared, doggone it, that idea went right out the window. And it wasn't, I think when we had the final edit put together of the movie and I showed Ron and he asked me if I had ever used that, if I got around to using that idea. And I'm like, no, Ron, the bear ran off in the woods, okay? And to this day, I'm still, doggone it, that bear really blew that whole opportunity for me to make that. But that movie was a lot of fun. It ended up being a big hit for Republic Pictures, and they actually did a pre-sale on another Bigfoot movie that they asked me, PM Entertainment asked me to write and direct. And they said, it's going to be called Little Bigfoot, and here's the story. Well, once they outlined and put the story on the table in front of me, it wasn't my story. It wasn't something that I, using my own creativity, that I came up with. And so I didn't have a desire to direct another Bigfoot movie and be known as the Bigfoot guy. And so I politely declined and wrote and directed another movie called Two Bits and Pepper, which was another family-oriented film, a lot of fun, and used an actor, a very funny comedian named Joe Piscopo, who played two roles for me in the film, and an actor named Dennis Weaver, who is no longer with us, but was an incredible actor. And I think he was in Steven Spielberg's first movie called Duel. I think that was Steven Spielberg's first film. And this, yeah, he was a great actor and a great man to work with. But yeah, that Bigfoot movie, they did the sequel, Little Bigfoot, and then they developed an animated TV series, you know, a cartoon called Mighty Bigfoot, based off the characters that I had created. And I was very proud of that, even though financially I didn't benefit from it. It was still something that I was very proud of. Listen, I will share more Bigfoot stories with you on another episode, because there's many more bizarre, crazy stories about that movie, the making of that movie, if you care to hear them. And thanks again for listening to Stunt Stories. I hope you've enjoyed the stories that I've shared with you today. And if you would consider subscribing, that would be fantastic. And if you could help me promote this little Stunt Stories podcast by telling your friends, I would greatly appreciate it. God bless you. Have a great day.